Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure that you register for the Here We Still Stand regional event. That's the event in Northwest Arkansas. Sells out every year. It's the first weekend in May. 2 days, Chad will be there, and I will be there as well, along with a whole bunch of other people. Hey, you come. We're having a pre-conference at that event this year. First time that we're doing a pre-conference. And you know what our pre-conferences are like if you've been to a conference. It's live podcasting. Live podcasting extravaganza. And will this podcast be recording? You know it will. So you want to come and hear a live recording of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, make sure you sign up. Come hang out with me and Chad in the beautiful Ozarks. It's going to be a good time. A link is in the show notes, or you can go to the website, go to the events page, and scroll around until you find it in the list of events. Chad, we are still in Job chapter 2, but we're at the very end. We kind of stopped at a natural spot. This was maybe a little bit of a... It's kind of weird. It's not like it was a bad chapter break, because you get into other things in the next chapter, but it definitely is a break in how this goes. Job has been suffering, man. He has had a deal, a challenge has been accepted by God regarding his piety, and man, oh man, is he going through it. And so the devil has taken away all his prosperity. He's taken away his servants and his livestock and even his children. His houses have collapsed. Job, he wasn't going to sin with his lips. He's not going to utter a word against God through all that. And so God decides that he's going to brag on him a little more, and the devil says, well, you got to let me touch his body, dude. Like, for so far, I've just taken away everything around him, but you haven't let me touch him. So let me touch his body a little bit, and we'll see what happens. And God says, well, all right, but you can't kill him. And Job might be wishing that that was not the case right about now, as he is in a dirt heap scraping boils from his body with broken pieces of pottery. And his lovely wife, the one person in his life that the devil did not remove for maybe obvious reasons, now says, hey, you holding fast to your integrity? Because I think you should probably stop this charade, curse God, and die. Job tells her, you sound like one of those foolish women. I don't know who those foolish women are, but that's who she sounds like. And we ended with Job saying this remarkable thing, man. Like, and in some ways, Chad, like an impossible thing to say. It's an impossible thing to come out of the mouth of someone who is suffering like this, who is a sinner, which of course Job is. This is something that could only be uttered from faith, which is, shall we receive good from God, not evil, and all this. Job did not sin with his lips, and that's where we ended. It just seems like an impossible response.
Yeah, and I think it seems that way, and it fits though with the rest of the seemingly impossible descriptions of Job.
Yeah,
you know, he's like the cream of the cream of the crop as far as people go. He's a sinner. Yeah, I mean, we all are sinners, but he's got it. You know, he's got, and at the beginning, he's got everything. He's righteous. He's God fearing. He has all this stuff. But even when all this is taken away, he's still that way. So that's, he is the remarkable of the remarkable. And that last confession, yeah, shall we receive good from God and shall we not receive evil? When you see that contextually, given everything he suffered, that is, yeah, it's one of the most remarkable confessions that we have in the scriptures. So with all that happening to him, now we're going to meet his three friends.
In times like this, you need some friends to come along. This is what you need. I would hope, Chad, that if I was really going through it on this level, you know, like my boys would come around, lift me up, yeah, encourage me.
We'll show up.
Come on, man. Like, if you, when you, you know, when you're hurting, maybe this is, I can't speak to the ladies. I don't know how this works with the ladies. But I know for guys, like, sometimes when everything's falling apart, you need your guys, right? You need the guys to come along and kind of hold you up a little bit. And you need friends. Not like, yeah, these friends.
I'll show up in Ash Heap, Arkansas. Yeah, I won't bring the book of Job. I'll just bring the Psalms.
There we go.
So we can say some Psalms of lament together. So when Job's three, this is 2:11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place. And so we get introduced to these three guys whose names are Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Naamathite. So of these three, Eliphaz, the Temanite, he seemed to be the leader of the three. I mean, he's the first to speak. So Job's going to speak first at the beginning of chapter three. So Job is going to open he's going to break the silence, and he's going to begin. But Eliphaz is going to be the first to respond to him. And he has the longest speech of all three of these. And I would say he's probably the most rhetorically talented. He uses the most rhetorical devices in these speeches. And also, interestingly, you get to the very end of the book, Job 42. And notice what God says. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz, the Temanite, "My anger burns against you and against your two friends." So he doesn't name all three of them at the very end. He names Eliphaz. So he seems to be the leader of these three. He's called a Temanite. That is synonymous with Edom. So that's why a lot of people think that the source of this might have been Edom originally. But anyway, that's where he comes from. The second guy is named Bildad, the Shuhite. We don't know too much about where he came from, you know, what the Shuhite means or anything like that. And then the third, Zophar, he's the guy with, he only speaks a couple times. And we know his name. We know that he's a Naamathite, but we really don't know anything about that place. So most of what we're going to figure out is just gleaned from the speeches of these three guys as we go through.
What's interesting about it, Chad, is that when you first read it, and it's going to take for you to get to chapter four before you start really seeing how this plays out. But initially, like when you just start, you know, from verses 12 and 13, this seems like exactly what you should do. Like, what they're going to do seems like...
They start well. Yeah,
yeah, this is what you do, man. Like, I mean, it even has a motivation ascribed to them, which is that the goal here is to show him sympathy and to comfort him. And that this is really good. And they're gonna wait with it. Like, there's some sitting in grief and suffering that's good. Mm-hmm. But... I don't know. It seems as though the patience runs out. Like they're waiting for something to happen that isn't going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When Job finally opens his mouth, they're probably, I'm guessing here, but they're probably expecting a confession.
Yeah.
Like, thanks guys for coming. I know there's been 7 days of a pretty intense silence here, but I think it's finally time that I just came clean and told you what I've done that has resulted in this divine visitation and punishment upon me and my family. And when he doesn't begin that way, we'll see when we get there, but they each begin to respond in their own way. But yeah, they make it an appointment. They come to show him the sympathy and comfort to comfort him. Now later, it's kind of funny. Chapter 16, Job will say, "Miserable comforters are you all," which is one of my favorite lines in the book of Job. "Oh yeah, you are just top-notch comforters. Let me tell you, you're making me feel better every time you open your mouth. My soul is uplifted by your speech." So, I mean, to give the guys credit, they do start out well. They see him from a distance, and it says they didn't recognize him. And that makes sense. I mean, if I'm stripped down to my loincloth, which is probably what was happening here with Job, and I'm covered head to toe with sores, I've been scraping them, I probably would not be recognizable either. You know, dirty, filthy, lost weight, just disfigured. So their first response is actually, all of this beginning is great. They see him, they don't recognize him. And so what, they raise their voice and they wept. So, you know, we do have to give the guys credit. I mean, they begin with this great sorrow. I really do think these guys are friends. And now maybe they'll turn out to be great friends or great comforters for sure. But the reason they came was a good reason.
Yeah.
They really actually, I think they really cared about Job. And they tear their robes. They sprinkle dust on their own head. Sort of. So they're getting dirty too, just like Job. And they sit with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. So that's pretty remarkable. I mean, if you take this literally, can you imagine? I go, say it's to your hospital room, not even a dung heap, all right? You're in the hospital bed, you're suffering. and I just sit with you, and neither of us says a word for 7 days. That itself is hard to fathom. But that's what happens. So a whole week goes by. They just sit in sorrow, in silence, in sympathy, and are being there basically, you know, the what do we call that? The ministry of presence, some people talk about, just being there. Yeah, well, there's something to be said for that. You know, you're not alone. This is what happens when you lose someone too. It's, you know, it's, you need to be alone sometimes, but it's also good to be, have people around you so you don't feel like you're isolated.
Yeah, this is actually fairly instructive of if you do have a friend who's suffering greatly, it's probably unwise to go in with your prepared words of consolation and comfort. And there's maybe a time for that, but initially, the best thing you can do for people who are, I mean, Job is no doubt mourning here as well, is to just sit with them in it. So this sort of a shared grief, right? Where you don't pretend like you have some words that can, that time is later. Like, there is certainly a time to, you know, in our context, we would say to give that person the gospel and the hope of the resurrection and all that kind of stuff. But it's usually not immediate, especially if you're in their actual presence, but it's rather to sit there and say, like, I'm going to whatever degree I can sort of bear this with you, right? I'm going to sit in it with you. And that's the best thing you can do, at least initially, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, at least initially, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think back to when Luke died, and, you know, a lot of people said a lot of things, but it wasn't the words much that mattered. It just was, they were there, they cared. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the initial impact. You know, that's what made the impression upon me. It didn't have to be some, you know, long speech or anything like that. Just saying, sorry, you know, my heart's broken for you, or no words, or whatever it is. I mean, all that stuff just makes an impact. And over time, you're ready to hear words. But at first, yeah, just being there makes a huge difference. So anyway, that's the first two chapters. So chapter three, Job breaks the silence. He is the one who, which is good. I think he's the first one who needs to speak here. And man, when he does, we see a different side of Job.
He's been saving it up.
If all you knew about Job was the first two chapters, which unfortunately I think is sometimes the shallow impression that people have of him. Oh yeah, this very stalwart, faithful, almost, you know, stoical, acceptor of all of this misery that's fallen upon him, this patient, faithful, bearer of burdens, you know, all that kind of stuff. Well, I don't want to discount that, but that's a very small side of Job. You have to read the rest of the book to hear about the rest of what he's going through. So Job opened his mouth, and which is a phrase we see actually quite a few places in the Bible. Sometimes I think it's just stereotypical. Sometimes I think it's used for like a rhetorical way of opening an important speech. I think this occurs in Matthew 5. Jesus opened his mouth on the Sermon on the Mount and began to speak. So it's this idea of, okay, it's not just simply saying he started to talk. It's a rhetorical way of signaling something important is about to be said. So here, Job, I think when he opens his mouth, it's the idea it's been shut for so many days, so long, and now he's finally ready to speak. And what he does after he opens his mouth is it says he curses the day of his birth. Now, it's an important object there. He never curses God like his wife told him to. Literally, in Hebrew, it's a little bit debated how this should be translated, because even the most translations render it the day of his birth. In Hebrew, it's just literally he cursed his day. Now, he goes on to curse the day of his birth explicitly. But, you know, maybe he's talking here not even, you know, specifically about his birthday, but just the day of his life, we might say, or where he's at now, or whatever it might be. But anyway, that's literally in Hebrew, just the cursed his day. And Job said, so this first chapter is going to be basically divided into three sections. He's going to begin by cursing the day, not only of his birth, but even of his conception. And then it's going to go on to say, well, if I had to be born, I wish I would, could have at least died when I was born. That's verses 11 through 19. And then at the very end, he's going to say, well, since that didn't happen, since I didn't die when I was born, then let me die now. That's the gist of this entire first chapter. So here's a guy who's at such extremities, emotionally, physically, in every other way that you can think of, that death would be welcome. Now, he never says anything about suicide. So it's like suicide is not even on the table. But what he wants, if he can't change the past, if he can't change the fact that he was conceived and born, if he can't change the fact that he didn't emerge from the womb, was stillborn, then at least God could be gracious enough to take him out of this life. So that's where we're going with this. So verse 3. I don't know how much of this I'll read, but let me at least take this first section. Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived. Let that day be darkened. May God above not see it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning. Because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. So there you have Job's opening speech.
That's quite a thing to hear after 7 days of hearing nothing.
Yeah, can you imagine the three friends? Probably a shocked expression on their face when Job started out this way. Of all the things, I think, anyway, of all the things they expected him to say, this was not it.
Yeah.
In fact, it's not what I would expect. I mean, if he had been silent that long, I would have expected maybe the first words to be basically a lament over everything he'd lost. That would make sense. I mean, a typical biblical lament about the loss of his family, of his kids, of his possessions, you know, of his health, all the things. And yet that's not the way that he begins. He begins by cursing the day of his birth. In fact, going all the way back to his conception.
When you've lost everything, when his family is gone, it would seem then at that point that you're like, so is it better to have been born and experience all of this suffering and all of this pain? Or would it have been better if you could say, you know what, actually, if I had not... If the day that I was born could be struck from existence, what happens in the balance? Well, a whole lot of suffering is eliminated. At this point, it would be very difficult to ascribe anything to your life but building towards immense suffering. I mean, I'm sure he has all kinds of joyful memories of his children and all this stuff, but when in suffering like this, at least initially, you feel there's a betrayal there that feels like everything good in your life was actually just setting you up for a pain that is indescribable, right? Like all of the goodness that you like ever experienced before from the day of your birth to this moment has all been a big, long setup so that this would be as painful as possible. And what would be better if I could just get out in front of it all. And eliminate it. Because at that point, it's not, I mean, you know this, Chad, it's not that like you can't get to the place, of course, where then joyful experiences, even if they're now in the past, you can identify as valuable and something you cherish. But in the midst of it, you're like, no, this is all, these memories hurt. Like all of the past joy is now just compounded my suffering.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think in those kinds of situations, pain becomes the prism through which you view everything.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, it's hard to see past the wall of pain to all of the pleasures and the goods and the blessings that came before it. And that's kind of where Job's at, especially right now. You know, so he'll if time went on, he'd be able to get past that wall of pain and to look, say, oh, well, yeah, but if I hadn't been born, then I wouldn't have experienced this, this, and this. I wouldn't have experienced the joy that I have with my children. I wouldn't have experienced, you know, all the things. And he goes on in the rest of the book to talk about, you know, even the people that he's helped over the years. But right now, he is just so suffocated by the darkness of pain and grief that he can't see past all that.
Yeah.
So he's one of these people that, you know, but it would have been better if I had never been born.
Yeah. Imagine if you know, so someone close to you dies and you're right in it. And now you have to compound that like times 10 and then a lot of other loss, all the suffering and your body's falling apart. It's a mountain of things. But then if you're in the midst of that and someone hands you a photograph of the person you've lost, like this, you don't look at that with like this is they might as well be handing you a knife, right? I mean, you get to the point where then you could go back and look at that same photograph with fondness, and you might it might still hurt, and it will bring up emotion, but it's not the same thing. Like in that moment, it feels like it's going to kill you.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. I mean, everything he's going through. In my small experience of pain rings true. And you know, if this strikes anyone listening to it, I mean, if you never heard this before, it's just like kind of biblically outlandish. It's not isolated just to Job. So listen to this. This is from Jeremiah. I think Jeremiah takes it up a notch. Cursed be the day on which I was born, the day when my mother bore me. Let it not be blessed. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, a son is born to you, making him very glad. Let that man be like the cities that the Lord overthrew without pity. Job is lamenting, but Jeremiah is like cursing the guy that brought the good news to his dad that a son was born, and let that guy be like Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, this is not isolated to Job. This happens to Jeremiah too. So there's some, I mean, they are not hesitant to use the most exaggerated language imaginable to talk about the grief that has been boiling up inside them, Job and Jeremiah both, as well as you see this kind of stuff happening all over the Psalms too.
Well, one of the things that's nice about the scriptures is that when you have the words, when you have someone open their mouth, is that the Bible does not read like an instruction book of here is the appropriate way to respond to this and that and the other thing, and here's how faith can inform your suffering. It doesn't what it does. Like what it does is it says, and here's how this sounds. Like when someone is in this situation and they open their mouth, this is the sort of thing that comes out. And Job, of course, unarguably is a man of faith. Look at the way that he's talked about. And this is what comes out of his mouth, which means that you can know that the faithful suffer, and it sounds like this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's you can use this. You can use Psalm 22. I mean, was there ever a greater man of faith than Christ himself?
Right.
I mean, yeah. Of course not. He perfectly trusted, right? And what does he cry from the cross? My God, why have you forsaken me? So that is... I think that's why lament is the quintessential cry of faith. You don't cry, you don't lament to a God that you don't believe doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. You don't lament to a God that you think is not there. The very purpose of lament is to cry out to the one that you believe is there.
Yeah.
So lament, rather than being a signal of the absence of faith, is actually a sign that faith is very much present. Doesn't mean that the faith is happy with the situation. Of course it isn't. That's what lament is all about. So, in these opening verses, you got, I love the, some of the language here. And we're reading in English, of course. And the Hebrew is, as I think I mentioned a couple episodes ago, very complicated, but it's just so rich too, because the day, the light, that contrast between it and the night, the darkness, the deep darkness, the thick darkness, all of this is kind of woven in there. You get to the end. I have to mention this phrase. Look at verse 9. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning. Isn't that a beautiful phrase? It's probably like some people explained it. It's like So the morning here is almost a personification, almost like a woman's name. And so some people explained it like, you know, when the sun's coming up, you see the first rays of light. It's kind of like eyelids that you're seeing, so these eyelids or eyelashes, or rather eyelashes of light that are coming out there. So it's in the midst of this painful, dark poetry, you've also got this light that's coming through. What else was I going to mention? Oh, yeah. We should say something about Leviathan. He comes up here in verse 8. I don't think we have ever encountered him in 40 minutes, have we?
I don't think
Leviathan has ever come up. Now, because he does, and he's going to come up elsewhere in Job. He's going to come up in Isaiah, as well as some other places too. But I don't think that we have encountered him so far. So Leviathan is this sea monster.
Yeah.
He's a big part of, so if you've ever read anything about Canaanite mythology, this idea of a primordial chaotic sea monster is a huge motif in that. So what you'll see oftentimes in the Psalms, you see it in Isaiah, you see it, of course, here in Job, is biblical writers will borrow and adapt some of this, what we would refer to as mythological imagery and language to talk about, you know, whatever they're discussing. It's not an endorsement of the mythology, but just like, you know, preachers and writers today will borrow from events or images or people from Greek, Roman mythology. You know, maybe we compare Samson with Hercules or whatever it might be. So the biblical writers did too. It seems to be what's being said here is that, so let those cursed who curse today, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. In the Hebrew, it's like their skill to rouse Leviathan. It's maybe the idea of Job saying, you know, I wish the people who could like call upon this sea monster would do it, and he would rise up and swallow the sun or something like that. But we'll hear more about Leviathan as we work our way through Job, because he's got quite a bit more to say about him. But that's kind of the background of what this figure is. So basically, those first 10 verses are Job saying that he wished he had never been not only born, but that if he could go back and he could take the night in which he was conceived and kind of just blot that day out of the calendar, then he would do it. But of course, this is all, I mean, it's a lament, it's a curse, but it's sort of vain in the sense of you can't do that.
Yeah.
You can't go back and cancel the day of your birth. So maybe it's this,
like, okay, I can't like remove the day of my birth from the calendar of history. I wish I could do that. I can't do that. But since I can't do that, all right, fine. Like, if I were going to be born, why couldn't have I died immediately?
Yeah, that's where he goes next. So verse 11, why did I not die at birth and come out of the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, and why the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth, who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. So, yeah, it's quite a description of it's not named here explicitly, but he's talking about Sheol, the place of death, right?
Yeah,
so,
well, yeah. I mean, the argument.
Why couldn't I have gone to the place of death, where everybody else is basically past the troubles of this life?
Yeah, well, he even argues that, hey, okay, so what would have been nice is if I'd been born and then like died immediately. Even maybe like I wish my mom hadn't nursed me. That would have been great. Considering the situation I'm in, like that would have been better. And then kind of goes into this thing where he's like, look, who experiences death? Like I could have gone to where everyone else goes. Like everyone is better off than me right now. Like everyone who has died is in a better spot than me. Kings with all their gold, they have houses of silver, rebuilding massive monuments. They're better off than me. But you know who else is better off than me? Thieves, Like everybody, prisoners, like the wicked, like there's not a single dead person that's not better off than me right now.
Yeah, he democratizes everybody. He's like, well, you know, it doesn't matter how much they had this life or how wicked or how good or anything like that. They're all better off because they've gone to the place of rest. They're dead. He's not really thinking here about, you know, he's not thinking in the Christian way of heaven and hell. He's just thinking of they're gone, right? They're in the place of death. And there, you got the small, it kind of brings them together, verse 19. The small and the great are there. It doesn't matter how small you are in life. Doesn't matter how great you are in life. Doesn't matter if you're slave or master, whatever. Then you're at rest. You've ceased from troubling. So, you know, if I didn't die at birth, then that's unfortunate, because then I would have entered into this place much sooner than where I am now, where I'm stuck in my sufferings. So having said that, he's gonna go in the last section, verse 20 through 26, to basically say, well, then, okay, if I had to be born, and then if I didn't die at birth, then why can I not die now? So verse 20, why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. Then he ends with three noughts and one is. I am not at ease. I am not quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. And in many ways, that kind of sums up everything that Job is experiencing is condensed into those four statements at the end. I'm not at ease. I'm not quiet. I have no rest. So I don't have those three things. But what I do have in spades coming at me on all sides is trouble.
Yeah, it's almost like he's saying here, there's a lot of people that would like to not die that do. What is the deal with someone who I dig for death like it's a hidden treasure. Like I would, there's nothing better for me right now than if I could die, and it does not come. Like this whole arrangement is off, right? So maybe there's someone out there who is dying who would like not to. We could swap, because that's the only thing I want now.
Gladly trade places with you. Yeah, absolutely. And did you notice too, verse 23? This struck me when I was going through this. So why is light given to the man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Remember earlier how when Satan first approaches God, he says, well, of course Job is the way he is, because you've hedged him in, right? You've protected him from all these terrible things, and you've blessed him in all these ways. And now Job comes along. Of course, he didn't hear this conversation, but he employs the same metaphor. God has hedged me in. So it's the idea, not he's hedged me in to protect me. So you know, my tall fences that kept trouble away have now become iron bars that have shut me in. He's switched the imagery, in other words. God has trapped me here.
Well, sometimes you have it backwards, right? Job seems to have it a little bit flipped here, where he's like, man, God has built like a wall around me in this suffering. And you're like, no, God removed a wall. And that's what's going on here. Your problem is not that you are hedged in, my friend. Your problem is that you've been de-hedged.
Yeah. The hedge has been removed, and all of the stuff has attacked you. You know, I was just thinking, it's interesting too, that, you know, we know, of course, we're privy to the heavenly scene. We saw the two discussions between God and Satan. Of course, Job has no idea of why any of this is happening to him, which, of course, is the impetus behind one of the reasons, anyway, why he is lamenting the way he is and why he speaks the way he does throughout the book, because he doesn't know. We do. But what's interesting is that Job, you know, he never brings Satan into this. He never says, why, oh God, have you allowed the evil one to do this to me? His concern, his lament, his words are always directed at God specifically. So when he thinks about everything happening to him, he doesn't think about chance. He doesn't think about the devil. He always thinks in terms of God, which I like, because it means that if you're taking your problems directly to God, then you're taking your problems directly to the only one who's actually able to do something about it. That's one of the things I love about the Old Testament's focus upon God did this, God did that. Not saying there's not, you know, secondary causes and all that kind of thing. But one of the things that's good about that is when you take your laments, your pains, your problems, your complaints directly to God, you're actually taking it to the source, the only source who's going to be able actually to answer and to do something about it. And that's ultimately where Job is going with this.
Yeah, I think Job is really informative in that way, because obviously throughout the Old Testament, there's like not a lot of devil focus from people of faith. Like, people of faith don't like really attribute anything to the devil. I mean, they're never like, the devil has done this, or the devil is doing this thing to me, or tempting me, or persecuting me, or whatever it is. They don't do that. What makes Job remarkable is that it's one of the only times where you have it said explicitly that it is the devil. That is who is doing this. And Job still doesn't do that. And sometimes as Christians, I think we do that a little too much. So a lot of times, first of all, you probably, you might be prone to attribute things to the devil that he really has nothing to do with. It's mostly just life in a sinful world. And the devil's probably not like individually paying attention to you. He's not omnipresent. He's not like, you know, really concerned about, you know, Chad Bird, and like the devil is uniquely after him. However, in Job's case, it is the devil who is uniquely after him. I mean, Job is being persecuted by the devil himself. It makes no reference to it. Like, he directs everything to God.
Yeah, which then is going to allow him to deal directly with the only one who's going to be able to answer him in the end.
Yeah.
It's not going to answer him in the way that he expects, but he will give him an answer. And one of the great things about, I mean, this has been pointed out by probably every commentator on Job, every teacher on Job, but it's worth mentioning here, because I don't know that we have, maybe in the opening episode. But what's so instructive about Job's approach is that in comparison with what we'll see the three friends do, is the three friends consistently talk about God, but they don't talk to God. Never. Job, on the other hand, talks to God. He will talk, you know, maybe not directly, but indirectly to his friends. But he is the real theologian in the group, because he addresses his words to God and not just talks about God. And that way, of course, just like the psalmist, who takes the hallelujahs as well as the complaints, laments directly to God himself.
Yeah, because you might miss that. You might think that, all right, Job's sitting there with his friends for 7 days, finally opens his mouth, and this is somehow directed to them. Like, he's not asking them these questions.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And if, as we go through the speeches too, I mean, you can call them arguments, speeches, whatever. Even these we'll see. I mean, there's not like some sort of logical progression of argument. You don't see, we'll see some kind of responses back and forth to each other, but these almost stand as independent speeches. Mm-hmm. They're like, they're each putting forward their argument or their speech. And there's some element of responding to each other, but don't kind of take this as like a court case. Okay, there's his argument, and I'm going to respond to it. He's going to respond to me. It doesn't work that way. And most of Joe's speeches, even though like their audience is partially the friends, the main audience is God himself. Yeah. He is the one that Job is crying out to in these speeches.
Yeah. This is a crying out to God but there's an audience there to hear what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. That's it. And that's 40 minutes.
That is it, man. We are out of time. That is the rest of chapter 2 and chapter 3. We will next week get into, get to hear from somebody else and see see how this hit the ear of his friends and see if they're like, that's a good question, Job. I wish I had an answer for it. I don't think it's going to go quite that way. You'll have to come back next week to find out how that goes down. Chad, I will see you then.
All right. See you then.